Hey everyone, Chat Cemetery is back, as is Katie Schaefer. Today we are talking about Stephen King's 1996 novel, The Green Mile. We both consume this a little differently, so I want to start this off, Katie, by talking about the way the book was released and the different ways you can now read or listen to this book, because I personally read the six little novels that contain the whole story. So the original serial release, and I know you did the audiobook, so you had probably some extra stuff that I didn't have, right?
Yes. I think I'm assuming the Audible adaptation is just straight from the regular novel. That's probably the easier way to get it now. And there's an intro, you know, the constant reader intro that he periodically does about how the book got released and or how the book got made as a serial, because he was approached about that and why he did it, and a little bit just about how it was invigorating for him to do it that way, to do something different. So it was interesting. All of his constant reader stuff is, but
yeah, I do have a foreword that is titled, you know, Dear Constant Reader at the beginning there, but it's from October of 95. So maybe we did end up having the same thing, but yeah, it's a quick, like, 6-8 pages, if that, on just sort of the serialization of the story. So maybe we did have the same thing there, but I know that when they started releasing it as just one book, I think there was maybe a different introduction there, because that happened so much later.
Yeah, I think so too.
But for those of you who are not in possession of the six little cute books here, I want to quickly give you the titles of them, just because I think that'll give you a better idea of how the story was split up originally. So part one is The Two Dead Girls, part two, The Mouse on the Mile, part three, Coffee's Hands, very important part, part four, The Bad Death of Edward de la Croix, part five, Night Journey, and part six, which is the longest of the six, is Coffee on the Mile. So you have it split up in a way that kind of leaves you wondering what's going to happen next, which I think is very key when you're serializing something.
Yes, yes. Have you ever read a serialized book before, or a book that was originally a serial, like most of Charles Dickens' stuff was?
Honestly, the only serialized thing I have ever read are comic books.
Okay. It's not that different then, actually. I've read, there's a couple of different ones I have read, and all of them are from like the 1800s and a little after, including Gone with the Wind. And it is very interesting when it happens, because it's almost like a TV show, like how it is in this book, where there's a big chunk of story and then, like, not necessarily a cliffhanger, but it leaves you wanting more. And that is the way all serials work. It's almost like it's a contained little story within a much larger one. And I think that is very much represented in this one.
This was one of the first of his novels that I read too, because these copies are my mom's copies. And I just remember always seeing them on the shelf. And I was like, look at those little books. Look at them.
They're
I just
so
wanted
cute.
To read them. I probably read this story way sooner than I should have, though, because it might have been like pre-high school when I read it.
Hey, that's how you read Stephen King.
It is. That seems to be how it happens. It was, you know, like this, Cell, and The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon were some of the early ones that I read, because either people had gifted them to us or to me in particular, or I just thought that, you know, The Green Mile would be easy to read because it was split up into nice little chunks. And, you know, each one is about 92 pages, give or take. And then the final one is 138 pages. So when you break it up like that, you could read a lot of the sections in one sitting, which was nice. Sometimes I would do it in two sittings just because, you know, you got to go to the store or something and you don't have necessarily the luxury to just sit there for an hour and a half or 2 hours to read straight through. But I like that it kind of gave you a different approach to King's stories, because you aren't just getting these giant bricks of text all at once. You're literally sitting there and like, okay, this one's done. Now I have to go get the next one. And there's a little more thought put into how he ended each one.
Right. I think so, too. I think it was because of how the book was written. I think he had to be much more conscientious about keeping his character development and the story moving at a good pace. And he didn't have the luxury of, like, taking his time. This required him to be pretty well edited, you know, and I think that's very evident. And it's very good. I think it was a good challenge for him because he's still able to have all that character development. It's just not as rich and deep as it is, which also contributes to length. And sometimes that can be a detraction from a book.
Yeah. Outside of John Coffey, who is the main character, but not necessarily the center of attention the whole time, I think there's not a whole lot of meat to some of the guards and some of the other characters. It's like he tells you who they are and you just go with it. You don't need backstory, really, on a lot of these characters, especially the criminals, because they tell you why they're there. And that's usually good enough for you to get an idea of who they are as a person. And really, the story is what makes this work so well, because not only do you have commentary on what the prison system was like back in the 30s, which clearly not great.
Yeah.
At all. Yeah. I mean, not that prison is great ever, but it's one of those things where you see just how, I guess, I don't even know how to put it, just how
brutal?
Cruel. Yeah, cruel and brutal it is to see them walk that green mile and just be put in this primitive chair. You know, that's what I was going for. It's very primitive. It's like, okay, we're going to do this. And if one little thing goes wrong, like the sponge isn't wet, it's going to go very, very poorly.
Yeah, horrific. Absolutely horrific. It's very different, not only in the brutality and the and all of that, but it's different in that, you know, there's no psychiatry, there's no understanding of a criminal mind. And so the guards are, at least we're getting it from, you know, the head guard, Paul's perspective, where he talks about, like, we don't want to upset them. You know, these men are under a high amount of stress. Like, it's my job to make sure that, you know, they're going to their death and they're not going to cause any problems. And in order to do that, like, I have to talk to them and, you know, help them come to terms with what's going to happen to them. And that is something that I didn't expect. And I'd read this book before, but I'd just kind of forgotten that part. And I think that was very interesting and led to a lot of great character moments because they're not focused on, you know, guarding these people. I mean, that's of course important, but they're focused on, like, getting them to the end with the least trouble possible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it made me wonder, like, is that what death row is like now? Like, do they have those guidelines? And is this something that wasn't just in a book? Is this something that, you know, those men actually did way back in the 30s? So, you know, and this book is set during the Great Depression, which adds a whole different flavor to it that is, for the most part, well represented in the book.
This was definitely one of those where if you read it young like I did, you definitely don't catch on to so many of the things. So going back and reading it again, I was like, oh, I see what you did here. And story-wise, it is one of those things where even though King didn't necessarily live during this time period, it feels like he has done enough research to understand the essence of how the prison system worked. And then he adds his supernatural twist to it, which is that John Coffey has this healing ability. And obviously, not all of it is going to age super well because, you know, he's this large black man who has magical powers, and it's a trope. It is by all means a trope, and it's one that you still end up liking in the end because you understand that John Coffey really was innocent and the prison system was broken and for all intents and purposes probably still is.
Right. It's just, yeah, the magical I believe, the magical black person trope. And King, this is not the first time or the last time King uses that right. trope. But I think in this instance, he doesn't, and he never does, he doesn't shy away from talking about how John Coffey being black makes it entirely different for him than if he were a white man. Like, it is not just inserted in there and King pretends like everything would have been fine, or it would have been the same if Coffey had been white. You know, he very much dips into what the racism at the time was like mm-hmm. and how just casual it was. And it's hard to read at times, but I think how he goes about it is pretty well done. And I think it's an interesting use of that trope. It's not necessarily, yeah, it doesn't necessarily age the best, but it's still an interesting thing to read.
And I don't think all horror tropes are necessarily bad. It's one of those things where this is a very horrific story, but in the broad sense of it, it really isn't a horror novel.
Yeah, definitely.
It's one of those things where, much in the same way that Rita Hayworth in The Shawshank Redemption is, it's more of a commentary on this certain time period, how people were treated, what prison was like. And this really gets to, I think, expand more than Shawshank did, simply because it's not a novella. It has more time to let you sit with these characters and you work through the guards figuring out that John Coffey is innocent. And because they're all white dudes, because that's who prison guards were in the 30s, they don't really think there's anything they are going to be able to change about it, because he was found over the dead girls' bodies saying that he couldn't take it back. So to anyone in their right mind, it's going to look like he's guilty. But as they see what he can do and experience it for themselves, especially once they take him out on his little night trip to go heal the warden's wife, they know that there is no way this guy who is taking pain away from people is capable of raping and murdering two little girls.
Right. And I mean, that's very clear, I think. And I think one of the best choices in this book is that the guards who know all of this have to live with the fact that, you know, they're murdering someone who is innocent. I mean, it's obvious that this job has been taking its toll on them, that they have to regularly mm-hmm. murder people for the state. Because then there were a lot more executions than there are today.
Yeah.
But they're actively murdering what one of them terms, you know, God's will. And that is incredibly draining on all of them. And I think that them having to go through the agony of understanding, like, just how brutally unfair their world is a big message in the book. I think it's one of the more impactful messages in the book.
Yeah, one of the things I love, too, is early on how they describe John Coffey in the book. You know, he's 6'8". And they say his weight was given as 280, but I think that was only an estimate. He had to have been 320, maybe as much as 350 pounds. So just those two descriptive sentences there, you're like, wow, that guy is like linebacker status or something,
right.
You know,
he's
a big guy, or, you know, offensive lineman, for those of you who are understanding my football analogies here. But he's one of those guys who just towers over people. And obviously there are people like him that exist in this world. So many athletes are way taller than the rest of us. It's just how they were born. They have the genes to make them very tall. Not all of us do. And the juxtaposition between Coffey and literally everyone else, and even his cell, just makes you understand how this is a guy who has to try so hard just to keep to himself.
Right. He's conspicuous in all ways. When he is out in the world, everyone's going to notice him.
Yeah, it's kind of hard not to. But they talk about how he flew under the radar for so long. And it's sort of like this urban legend has built up around him almost, because they're like, oh, you know, we had sightings in the South, or one sighting in this particular state. And you're just like, it's kind of crazy that they're talking about this guy like some sort of urban legend, but you understand it more as the story goes on and you know what he can do. There's that story in here about how he just pulled people out of a fire and they were totally fine.
Right. Yeah. I think that's that I think it just adds this element to the book that makes it feel very of the times, because it's something that you probably couldn't do to, you probably almost certainly couldn't get away with today. You know, there's just too many cameras and too much. Whereas then it really was, you know, based on word of mouth and individual stories. And because in the Depression, like it talks about in the book, there were people just constantly on the move everywhere because everyone was trying to find some way to survive. And so he wouldn't have been as conspicuous then, purely because he would have gotten somewhat lost in the masses. It's almost like Mad Max type of thing, where he's the lone man who goes out and does these good deeds and then is and then vanishes.
Yeah, you also have the other people on the Green Mile who have clearly done things that we know they're guilty of. You know, you have Wild Bill.
Oh, God.
You know, and he is like 19 years old, and this guy killed a pregnant woman, killed three other people. And in here it says all he missed was a nun and a blind man. And that's when you know, like, this guy is dangerous. You know, he deserves to be here. We know that if he were ever let out, he would just keep going because he's only 19 and he's already racked up such a high body count.
Yeah. And he reminds me of the kid in The Stand that trash man runs into and like in the mountains or whatever, who's just this awful, nasty, like evil. Like,
what if they're the same?
I wouldn't be surprised. With King, you never know. You know, he feels evil and malevolent.
Yeah.
It feels very appropriate. Just someone who is wild and untamable and totally despicable as a human being. And he gets what's coming to him in a very satisfying way. I will say that.
He feels no remorse, whereas you can tell with Edward de la Croix, he understands that what he did was wrong. He regrets doing what he did. And you can tell he's not all there.
Yeah.
You know, upstairs, because he is friends with Mr. Jingles, a mouse. And I don't say that to be mean or demeaning to anyone who has mental illness or anything. The way the character was written and the time period, that's how they kind of talked about it. Like, something's not right with him. And like you said, there's no psychiatrist. There's no nothing offered in the prison other than your three meals a day.
Right.
So he is someone who probably more likely should have been in a mental institution, which back then it would have been an asylum, which maybe wouldn't have been any better. So maybe these guards are kind of the best he could hope for. But when you have a guard like Percy, who is really one of the biggest villains in this story too, it's very hard. And you feel bad for Edward the entire time, because you're like, okay, we know why he is being sentenced to death. We understand what he did and how bad it was. But you have to figure mental illness played a role in that. And there is something that now would be done. And again, I'm not saying that because of that this ages poorly. It is what it was for the time.
Yes, it's very accurate for the time. And I mean, yeah, asylums were not good places to be. They were barely, sometimes worse than prisons.
Yeah.
Because they didn't, people with those issues at that time were not really considered full humans. Mm-hmm. So more of a burden on society generally. So it's very interesting to have this character in there and to make him so sympathetic despite his admitted horrific acts. He displays remorse at the end, but you get the impression throughout it that he doesn't his remorse is more because of the circumstances he's found himself in, mm-hmm. rather than actual remorse for what he, for the lives he took. And so it's a little,
it feels like he's not really mentally capable of knowing what remorse is and should feel like, though.
Right. I agree.
Not because he's some sort of, you know, psychopath, sociopath. That seems way more up Percy's alley, because he is just so, so weird in this and so creepy. And when he has to do everything in his power to make people miserable, you're like, this dude should not be a prison guard at all.
Right? Oh, and the scary thing is like, you know that there's those people, like he feels too realistic, all too realistic. And because King gives him a lot of very delicate character development. Like we see who, we don't know much about Percy's life, but we see who Percy is and the choices that he makes and how he talks to other people. Like he's just selfish and self-absorbed and constantly injured. Like, oh, you didn't talk to me in the right way, so you've hurt my pride and you laughed at me. And like, he can't take anything anyway, except that it's a personal attack.
Yeah.
You know?
And he's also kind of an idiot, to be honest.
Yes, he's dumb. And you get the sense he's like, well, King says it very honestly, like he's vain for his hair and he's very attractive, King makes out in the book. So it's, you can just picture him in your head and it's like, oh, I know exactly what that kind of guy is like, because all of us have met him at least once.
Yeah. And they practice the executions beforehand. So in the second book, The Mouse on the Mile, you have them describing an execution that went well, if there were such a thing as a good one. And that's the execution of Arlen Bitterbuck, which is quite the last name. But then you have Percy and his sort of vendetta against Edward Delacroix. So when his time comes, you know, Percy's like, oh, well, we didn't wet the sponge when we were practicing. It's like, of course you didn't. You were practicing. You weren't doing it for real, but you should know to wet the sponge. And it's just one of those things where, because he is so vain, you see how fearful he is in that moment and how things just sort of start to fall apart for him. It's like, that is the turning point where we can kind of see Percy going downhill and this, you know, kind of rage comes out too, because when they take John Coffey out on his night trip, they have to shut him up for hours. So they put a straitjacket on him and lock him up in, isn't it the execution room?
No, it's the quiet room. It's okay. A room with the padded walls.
Yeah. Okay. Which is about as close to a mental institution as you're going to get on the Green Mile. So
yep.
It's one of those things where that's where they take the problematic people who just need to be put away in a corner somewhere so that they aren't disrupting the everyday happenings on the Green Mile for everyone else. Because even though these people are on death row, some of them obviously take it better than others. John Coffey never complains, never does anything. Then you have Wild Bill, who is certainly wild and unpredictable. So then you have just different personalities to try and contend with. So they have to have this place to put anyone who starts giving them a problem. And Percy is honestly one of the most problematic.
Yeah, he really is. And he really deserves that, because it's, you know, his choice to torturously kill Edward Delacroix because of the laughter is one of the most despicable acts that takes place in the book. There's a few, but that one is right up there. And it's, you get the sense that despite his immediate, like, oh, I didn't know that, which obviously he knew, he just didn't know what exactly was going to happen. Yeah. And his complete lack of responsibility, sense of responsibility, is he's so cowardly. And it's one of the things that shows, like, this is not a job that anyone can do. This is a very taxing, mentally draining job, because you have to be able to deal with them laughing at you. You have to be able to handle, you know, like when he gets attacked And then, or when one of the guards is being choked and he just stands there and hides. Like, you have to be able to deal with all of these really intense situations that can come up at the drop of a hat and not take them personally. And so it shows just how unfit some people are for this kind of job. Like, not everyone can be a prison guard, because to a certain extent, you have to have compassion for and forgiveness for the worst kind of people. And Percy has none of those things.
Exactly. Percy's problem is that he looks down on all of them as the scum of the earth. And what he doesn't understand is that you have to get these prisoners to respect you, which is exactly what Brutus and Paul Edgecombe do, because they know where these guys are going. So if they can have this mutual respect, it's going to go much better for everyone. But Percy being thrown into the mix just throws so much of that off.
He obviously doesn't view them as human. Views them as, like, almost toys. Like, he can beat up and poke at and be mean to without any repercussions because of who his connections are. And he feels, you know, they don't deserve any kind of compassion or thought. And it's makes him all the more cowardly, because if you consider someone a full human being, you have to look at what you're doing to them and question whether or not this is fair and this is right. And just looking at them as, you know, not real people makes it a lot easier to be cruel and nasty and uncaring about these people that you're, you know, shepherding along to the electric chair.
One thing about the story that we haven't touched on yet is the fact that this is a story being told from a future time. So the story isn't being told as it happens. It's being told years and years later by Paul, who is essentially our narrator. This is coming from his perspective. He's writing it all down while he's in a convalescent home, I guess. I don't know if they were necessarily called that, but it's obvious that he has been placed somewhere because of his health and his age, and he is working through all of these pent-up feelings that he's had for years about what happened to John Coffey. And I think that's a good way to present this story, especially as a serialized story, because it gives you a chance to kind of play with how the story is told, because memories aren't necessarily going to be totally accurate or totally linear either. It's kind of like what I touched on with Danny Ryan in our Birds of Prey episode on my other podcast, Welcome to Geekdom. It's like that storytelling method was not necessarily a mess, but it just wasn't linear because Harley Quinn doesn't think in a linear way.
Right. And I agree. I think using like almost a memoir style where he's going back and talking about it from a wider perspective allows us to also see how these events affected him, and both mentally and physically. And it adds something, you know, when we find out that Paul is 104 and still kicking and only looks like 80, which I don't know if you've ever seen a 104-year-old, but dude, you can tell they're 104.
Yeah.
And that is obviously from the effects of John Coffey curing his urinary tract infection in about, I don't know, the second chapter in the book. That adds a whole new layer to the effects of this story, because I don't know if I'd want to live to 104. That's a long time. And seeing that makes this story even more of a mix. You know, it's not a horror story necessarily. It's not, you know, a prison story necessarily. Like, it's all these different things combined.
I think that's something that King is good at doing, is blending these genres together. So it's not just one thing and you kind of know what to expect right from the start. It's like he always throws in this little twist to where you're like, oh, I didn't exactly see that coming. And we've talked about how he ends his novels. And I think because of how this one was written, it ended in a different way than it might have had he had time to just sit down and do the whole thing at once instead of be like, here, this needs to be released, this needs to be released, and so on and so forth. But I actually like the ending of this one because you're like, oh man, I was not expecting him to be 104, because you don't really sit there and do the math to know, like, oh, okay, well, this took place in 1932 and he had to be in his 30s or 40s probably because he's a prison guard. And then, you know, this is happening X amount of years later. I didn't feel compelled to do that math at all until they were just like, you know what? We're going to give it to you.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. King is really good at laying out the crumbs for that, especially because I know how he writes. And I know he didn't know the end when he started writing this story, because he never does. At least that's what he says. And from reading that little intro, you know, he started writing and was having the first book published before he finished writing the last bit. So that takes balls to be like, all right, well, we're going to publish this part and we'll just see how it all comes out. And for that, he lays out the crumbs, and you never really question how old Paul is. And then when that reveal comes, it's like, oh yeah, he's been talking about it. And there's no real markers for what time he's writing it. Like,
yeah,
because he's in the old folks' home. So, you know, they're watching TV, but it never talks about what kind of TV they're watching, except when it's old movies.
Yeah.
He plays that out so well that it's one of the biggest reveals in the book. And I just was like, oh, that's good. That's a skilled moment right there.
Especially when he then reveals around what ages everyone else passed away. You know, he talks about when his wife died, when the warden's wife died, and the warden himself, and just all of these people he knew from his time at the prison. He's kind of running you through and updating you on everyone else's life at some point, but you're still kind of like, okay, well, what time period is Paul in then?
Because right?
You are left sort of feeling like he's obviously the last one left, but the other ones died seemingly early enough to where you wouldn't think he was that old necessarily. Like, I think someone died when they were like 50 something or 60 something. So it's not like they were ancient by any means when they died. They were older, but not really that old. So you're kind of like, oh, that's, you know, unfortunate. So maybe Paul's in his 70s or 80s. And then you're like, oh, wow, that kind of hit you like a ton of bricks.
Yeah. And what did you think of the Mr. Jingles part in the end, that Mr. Jingles is still alive and kicking?
That was wild. I was like, no, it can't be the same house. But then you have him kind of like hiding the mouse in the home. And you're just like, all right, if Paul is this attached to the mouse, it has to be Mr. Jingles, and he has to somehow know.
Right? Right? And just, it felt so weird. And then, but then it has that scene with Brad, the orderly, who's a total dick, and very Percy-like. It almost reenacts the scene from where he kills Mr. Jingles on the mile, and now Brad comes in, and like, that scene was also just really, really well done, and it heightens the tension and also tells us, you know, that he's not going to live forever, which is a relief, because that is a fate worse than death, literally. Living forever without your body staying young. Ugh. Even with your body staying young, it wouldn't be too good. But yeah, I thought it wasn't my favorite part, but I did like what it added to the story.
Yeah, it gave you the sense that John Coffey really had an impact on his life, for better or worse, at that point in time. And it's unfortunate that, you know, the warden's wife ended up dying of natural causes, because then you're like, okay, well, clearly it doesn't save everyone. So maybe it depended on the fact that his was just a urinary tract infection and not cancer that John Coffey had to take out. Or, you know, depending on the level of sickness, I guess, will sort of depend on how much longer you live. So maybe if you're not as sick, John Coffey's powers have a longer lasting effect.
Right. And he did have the moment that I don't think anyone else has, where Coffey almost like gives him his power
yeah.
for a little bit, uh-huh. like right before the end for John Coffey. I mean, right before the death.
Yeah.
Like, and that scene is also, that also made me wonder, is this part of why he lived so long? Because he got to see the world from that intense perspective.
Mm-hmm.
But then the Mr. Jingles thing comes in. It's like, well, no, it can't just be that. Because why would you give a mouse those kinds of, you know? Don't think a mouse could handle that. Sensory overload.
Yeah, the ending is one that I think was well done. But it's not necessarily wrapped up in a bow for you. Because everyone else has died. Paul isn't necessarily alone. He meets another woman at the home who reads and gives him feedback on everything that he's writing. So he does have this new relationship that we see budding over those scenes. But because of how old he is and how much younger she is in comparison, even though she's obviously still older, and it's just one of those endings where you know it wasn't necessarily a happy ending because of everything that did happen to John Coffey, even though all of those men were just doing their job.
Right. It's a very bittersweet ending, and not a whole lot of sweet, mostly bitter.
Yeah.
But just a touch of sweet. But I agree, it's one of his better endings. I think it, and I think part of that is due to the fact that it doesn't have as nearly as much supernatural elements to it. I think having those supernatural elements makes it more difficult in any book
yeah.
to bring your ending together. But this one is satisfying. It's a very, and you almost don't, that kind of book, you can't have a happy ending and have it feel satisfying, because it's much closer to regular life.
Mm-hmm.
And regular life has no happy endings like that. You can't have, otherwise it will feel pat.
There's never really a happy ending in Wrongful Convictions that end the way that John Coffey's did. Because
right.
at the time, there wasn't necessarily as lengthy of an appeal process. I know there was still an appeal process, but to find someone who would be willing to go through that for John Coffey, and for John Coffey to even want to go through that himself, that's a hard sell. So we don't even get any of that. It's just like he has sadly accepted this fate that he's been given.
Right. And to a certain extent, he says that he's ready for it to be over because he's just tired.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that he's given too much, I think, is kind of the sense I get, that all of this healing and not being able to really make human connections on the level of him. Like, he can make human connections, but the connection is all on the other person's side because he doesn't really remember the way that we think that we do, because his world is just so overpowering. You get the sense that he isn't lying when he says that.
Right.
But the way he dies, despite it going quote unquote well, in that, you know, nobody caught on fire this time.
Right.
It's still horrible. Dying by electric chair is not going to be a pleasant experience, no matter how well, quote unquote, it goes. And you see it, the effect it has in that scene, not only on John Coffey, but on the men doing it. And I think it makes it even creepier where they take John Coffey to go do the healing, when he sees the electric chair and talks about they're all still in there screaming.
Yeah.
Like, that makes it all so much sadder.
Yeah. And you have the fact that they don't know if this is going to go well because of John Coffey's size. He's not the size of a typical man who is being put in this chair. In fact, they have to modify some of the clamps on the chair just so that they fit around John Coffey's legs. And putting that into perspective that way, where they kind of have the guy on standby in case the clamps don't close and he needs to modify them, you're just like, oh, you're kind of very tense and just hoping that it goes as well as possible for Coffey, even though this is not remotely the outcome that you want.
Right. It feels very anxious, that scene of, okay, what's going to happen? Is it going to go well? How is his death going to go? And it's a bit of a relief when it's over. Just, okay.
Whew. Yeah.
He's dead. He can't go through anything else.
He's at peace, finally.
Right. That's the term. He's very much no longer suffering.
Yeah, and this is just one of those stories that the commentary on the time period is well done. It obviously has some words and phrases that don't age well, but it's not because King was doing it from the perspective of the 90s. You have to treat this story as a 1930s story.
Right. I agree. I think King tries very hard to represent the time periods he's writing in. Like in It, when he's writing in the 50s time period, it's different than when he's writing in the 80s.
Yeah.
Like he really tries to make the reader feel as though they're right there with the characters. And I think he does a pretty decent job with this one. It's easier because, you know, you don't really deal with the world a whole lot. You're dealing with these very small settings and with things that haven't necessarily changed a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes it a bit easier. But I think when he is talking about the world, like when they're out and with the cars and all of that stuff, I think that gives it the right flavor so that we feel like we're in the 30s and in the Depression.
And it understandably makes you feel uncomfortable about what is happening in that time period, even though it's a time period we've never lived in. It's one you read about in the history books and you're kind of like, oh, that sounds horrible.
Yeah. Yeah. It wasn't an easy time to live through, for sure. And it's also feels accurate to the, like you said, the primitive nature, or the much more primitive, which is a loaded word to say the least, but in that it doesn't have all the technology we have now, it doesn't have the thinking we have now, and it's easier, you know, it doesn't look at that time period with rose-colored glasses.
Yeah, well, I know there's a lot to unpack with this, so do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
I think we covered it all with this one, or we covered a lot with this one, so I think I do want to say that I think this is one of King's stronger books,
mm-hmm.
and I really enjoyed it. And it was the first one of his I read that was not so strictly in the horror genre. And it surprised me at how well written it is and how good he is at writing in general. It's not just horror. He can pull off a lot of different things, which we see more when you get into like his mystery stuff that he's doing now and all of that. But I think this is a great book to show the growth that Stephen King goes through. Even God, you know what, Carrie is 1970 or mid 70s. And he's still writing in a different way and trying to push himself to do new stuff. And it still works. And I think that is an example of why he's such a strong writer that we're doing a podcast about him.
Yeah. One thing I do want to bring up is the moment when John Coffey gives Percy the sickness and then Percy turns around and shoots Wild Bill, because Coffey knows that they're both bad men. That's sort of how he puts it. He's not super well educated, but there's just this sense about him to where even though he's not well spoken and, you know, can barely remember how to tie his shoes, there's this purity to him as a character. And he knows that these guys are bad men. So even though he still knows he's going to die, he's not going to die from taking the sickness away from the warden's wife. He passes it on to Percy and makes sure that both Percy and Wild Bill get what's coming to them.
Yes. I think I got the sense that he can know people deep down. Like he can't, you know, necessarily remember who they are as a person day to day, but he can see them on a level of, you know, who they are in their deepest sense of self.
Yeah.
And that's where he gets the knowledge that Percy is a bad man. Like, all the way down, Percy is a bad man. And Wild Bill, I mean, it's not even all the way down. It's just everything is bad. And it is so satisfying when especially that he does that to Percy. And then Percy doesn't die from the poison. He is just completely hollowed out.
Yeah.
And no longer really there anymore. And that almost feels fitting for who Percy is, because he was so willing to take away in the most vicious way possible everyone else, anything he could from anybody else.
Absolutely. And like you said, this is one of King's better novels. And obviously, you and I have liked a lot of them that we've read, with the exception of Tommyknockers and maybe one or two others. But it's one of those things where this is clearly different than some of the other things because of how it was released. And I think given those circumstances and how he was put under this different pressure to write this, it turned out as well as it could. I know he said there's some inconsistencies and some things he would go back and change if he could, but I think every writer probably feels that way about at least some of their work that has been released. So it's definitely top tier King for me so far. And obviously with still about 2 years left of this podcast to do, I still have a lot of books to get through, but really this is one of those that stands out, and you can tell just by how sort of revered this story is, and even the adaptation that comes later on, just the big names they were able to get for that and how much time and effort was put into that adaptation to make sure they got it right.
Right. I agree. It is one of the better adaptations out there of any book, but also of a King book. And it's really well done. And the acting's phenomenal. And Michael Clarke Duncan gives the best performance in the whole film, I think. He's just so, he perfectly captures it. And I think this is a book that really benefits from a good adaptation.
Yeah, it's one of those things, too, where a lot of people have watched the movie and don't necessarily even realize that it's a King adaptation. So then you tell them and they're like, oh, okay, you know, that's right. Kind of different because it's not It or Carrie or The Shining, which are really these big horror stories that, yes, still have supernatural elements to them because King likes to mix his genres. But those are really seen as sort of the cult horror movies that people eat up when it comes to Stephen King adaptations. And obviously the adaptation will be a whole other episode, so right. I won't go on any more about it. But Katie, thank you so much for coming on to talk about The Green Mile today.
Yes, thank you for having me. This one was really fun.
Of course. Quickly, before we go, I want to let you all know about our Patreon. You could support this podcast for $1 a month, which will get you a thank you on the show, or $2 a month, which will get you a Chat Cemetery sticker. I don't have too many left, so if you would like one, sign up and I will send those out to you. And you can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook @Chat Cemetery. As always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the rest of your day.